All right, I guess we're going to start. We're going to get started then. My name is James Sanders. I'm an attorney here in town at a firm called Morris, Manning & Martin. And I wanted to thank, first of all, thank Scott and folks at DragonCon for letting me talk to y'all. We're going to be talking today about click wrap agreements, browse wraps, things like that. And I hope that by the end of it, you come away at least with a better idea as to how to sort of structure your agreements, better idea with respect to knowing some of the legal pitfalls that can happen when you're dealing with electronic contracting. How many people in here have actually put together an electronic contract, a click wrap or a browse wrap agreement? Anybody? Anybody put their own agreement together at all? How many people have actually entered into an agreement, a click wrap, browse wrap? Yeah, pretty much everybody in the room. I mean, it's pretty hard nowadays to avoid these kind of things. And of course, all of them are fairly onerous and you never know what you're getting into and nobody ever reads them and things like that. Well, I hope again that you'll have a better idea if you are going to be putting together your own agreements to deal with the licensing of software or licensing any kind of media or things like that. You'll find this at least helpful. I plan on talking generally about four things today, and what the first thing we're going to talk about is contract basics, just because all the basics of contracts, whether it's oral, written, whatever, they're all going to apply in the electronic world anyway. Then we're going to talk about some of the recent legislation that's been passed that governs electronic contracting. And we're going to talk about how that legislation structures the way you need to enter into agreements online and the things you need to watch out for. Then we're going to talk about some of the legal issues that are involved with electronic contracting, issues about enforceability and things like that. So if you're actually putting into place a contract, you know what to watch out for. And then finally, we're going to talk about we're going to kind of go over some practical pointers in the form of a how-to guide, which will hopefully help you think about what kind of transaction you're trying to structure, how you're trying to work it, and what you need to watch out for when you're doing that from a real high level of thinking about these kind of things. First of all, what is a contract? Well, a contract basically involves a situation where you've got something called consideration, which is a legal concept. And what that basically means is that you've got an exchange of promises to do something or refrain from doing something. So a good example of that would be, I offer to mow your lawn for $5 on Saturday, and you say, that sounds great, why don't you do that? We've got two promises. I'm promising to mow your lawn, you're promising to pay me some money for it. Another element of a contract is there's a manifestation of a mutual intent to actually be bound by the agreement of the parties. And so you've got to have offer and acceptance. I've got to say to you, mow your lawn for $5 on Saturday. You say, sounds great. I've offered to do something. You've accepted to do it. And we've got consideration. The other thing is that you've got to have material terms that are somewhat definite. So if I just said, I'm going to mow your lawn, you say, sounds good. We probably don't have a contract at that point in time because we don't know what the price is going to be. We don't know when I'm going to do it. We don't know exactly what I'm necessarily going to do if I just say I'm going to mow something. So you've got to have somewhat definite material terms. You don't have to fill in all the terms, obviously, but you've got to have something there. And then finally, a common misconception is that you've got to have a written document in order for a contract to be enforceable. That's completely not true. You can enter into oral contracts. You can enter into written contracts, and it doesn't really matter. And in fact, one of the most common contracts that exists is contract for marriage. When somebody says, will you marry me? I do. That's a contract. It's oral. Now, there are situations, of course, when you got to have a writing. And those situations are where a concept called the statute of frauds applies. And that's something that was passed a long, long time ago where people thought that certain transactions were so important that you need to have them in writing in order to make them work. And examples of that would be things like sales of land, for example, or situations where you're paying for goods that are more than $500 or services that cannot be performed within a year's time. Things like that, people felt, well, you know, there's too much of a chance that people could cheat and claim there's a contract when there's really not. And so for evidentiary reasons, they thought we have to have a writing there. And in most cases, a lot of the original sort of situations where writing was required have gone away, but there are still some legacy situations even today where you've got to have a writing in order for the contract to actually work. So with that in mind, we're now going to kind of focus on the recent legislation that's been passed, and I say recent, I mean in the past 4 or 5 years, that has basically attempted to deal with how should we be contracting online in the world where now everything's on the internet and there's EDI, et cetera. And the two pieces of legislation that generally cover this are UIDA and eSign. So we're going to talk about UIDA and eSign, and we're going to talk about what's in those pieces of legislation, what do they mean, what do they mean you have to do. And generally, both of them say the same thing. Both of them say that you've got, once you have an electronic contract of any kind, if you've got an electronic record or an electronic contract, it's going to basically be treated the same as paper. In other words, you're not going to say that just because you've used an electronic form rather than a paper form or an oral form, that you're not going to have a contract. And just to let you know what UIDA and eSign are, just to back up for a second, for those of you that aren't familiar with them, UIDA is something called the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. And that is something that was promulgated by a series of meetings that of sort of law people, law professors, lawyers, people like that, who came together and thought to themselves, you know, we need to come up with a uniform set of laws to deal with electronic contracting and click wraps and things like that, because at this point in time, which was around 1999, which is when this was passed, several states were already kind of putting out digital signature legislation and electronic contracting legislation and things like that, especially Utah. And the reason why they were doing that is because states were freaking out, state legislatures were freaking out, thinking, you know, we're entering this totally new paradigm of doing business. All this electronic media is coming out. People are, you know, dealing more with EDI. People are starting to contract on the internet, and, you know, what are we going to do, and does this comply with the statute of frauds? Are these contracts going to be valid and all this kind of stuff? And, you know, the funny thing is that the freak out wasn't completely unwarranted, because in Georgia, for example, there was a court of appeals case in the late 90s where a judge actually ruled that a fax did not constitute a writing for purposes of forming a contract. So there definitely were some judges who were not very, very sophisticated who were actually taking a dim view of the new media, and of course faxes isn't really new at all, but things like faxes and electronic transactions, and were actually calling into question whether they could be enforced under the statute of frauds. And so states were starting to adopt things, and so in response to that, people got together and said, we need a uniform law. So UIDA was passed. UIDA was actually ratified by about 40 states. And then the next year, the federal government got into the act, really, with something called eSign, which is the federal concept of, if you're dealing with the federal government, we want you to be able to do business electronically, and so we're going to set up a way for you to do that. And if you're in a state that hasn't passed eSign, you're going to be subject to this eSign legislation. So again, the general idea behind both of these was, we want to make it so that if people do business electronically, there's not going to be a question as to whether, you know, there's an enforceable contract or not. So again, the general premises are, we're not going to give you a problem if you're doing business electronically just because you use an electronic record in the formation of a contract. And it's important to remember that these aren't just about contracts. They apply to a whole host of things you may want to be doing in a business setting or with consumers. They apply to records, consumer notices, that kind of stuff. The idea being, if you do them electronically, we're going to let you go ahead and do that.
Were both of those predominantly business to business?
No.
Business to consumer?
They don't make any distinction. In other words, the general idea is that what we want to not have happen is someone, whether it's a business, a consumer, whoever, get into court and on the basis of an electronic record have someone say you don't have a contract or you haven't fulfilled your legal requirement because you've used an electronic document rather than using a paper document.
When are they considered to be additions to UCC then?
To the Uniform Commercial Code? They're not really additions to the Uniform Commercial Code, because the Uniform Commercial Code is something that governs how you do business, whether it's, you know, a sale of goods, for example, which is UCC Article 2, or commercial paper, which is UCC Article 9. And these laws aren't really substantive in terms of talking about particular subject matter and talking about how you're supposed to do business in that respect. What they do is they basically write an overall framework saying if you're doing any kind of transaction, and again, there are exceptions to this, if you're doing any kind of transaction, you can do them electronically. Now, some of the exceptions, of course, that are contained in both the acts are, for example, you've got trust and estates type documents, wills, things like that. Those are excluded. Articles of the UCC other than Articles 2 and 2A. Now, Article 2 is sale of goods. Article 2A is leasing. So, for example, commercial paper and things like that, what they basically said was, we want to let people who are dealing with those issues on the state level and the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, who does UCC, you guys can deal with those separately, because there are different issues when you're dealing with, you know, what's a valid check and things like that. And we want to let people determine those issues on their own. So they carved out the UCC other than Articles 2 and 2A. They also carved out something called UCETA. I don't know if people are here familiar with UCETA, but UCETA is the Uniform Computer Information Technology Act, and basically Transactions Act, sorry. And basically what UCETA is UCETA was the attempt by the people who promulgate the Uniform Commercial Code to come up with a way to deal with software licenses and things like that. And it was really a miserable failure. It's only been passed in two states, Maryland and Virginia. But knowing that that there was UCETA was out there, the people who drafted eSign and UEDA said, well, we're going to carve out UCETA from that, because we think that the particular act, which deals with computer transactions, should be able to take care of the electronic contracting issue itself. And so there are provisions of UCETA that deal with how you form a contract and things like that, which are similar to what's in UEDA and eSign, but there are some differences, especially in the consumer area. And then there are other exceptions as well. There are things like you can't send notices of cancellation of a utility electronically and things like that. Basically, some consumer protections were built in because people were afraid, and probably rightfully so, that people would start using electronic means as a way to basically abuse consumers in some way. So there are a host of other exceptions. And of course, California has its own list of exceptions. They decided to include, you know, one or two things that they didn't want to do. The good news is that most of these aren't contract-oriented exceptions. Most of them are, again, things that pertain to contracts for Medicare supplements, telecommunications notices and things like that. But if you know you're doing some kind of business in California, it's always good to check California statutes. And the unfortunate thing is, these aren't all contained in the California electronic transaction statute. These are scattered all over the place. They just simply say, refer to X, Y, and Z, and then you have to just kind of go seek these out. So a good rule of thumb is to beware when you do business in California. Now, one of the interesting things about the acts is that even though the idea behind the acts is that you can do business electronically and we want to make the electronic documents basically the same as paper documents, the acts both do impose additional requirements on you when you're doing business electronically that are really not present when you're doing business on paper with pen and ink. One of those is that you have to actually keep records of the transaction that you do. And the other is that you've got to be able to provide access to those records. So if you don't do one of those two things, you risk that the contract will be per se unenforceable, which, again, these requirements aren't present in the paper world. Now, it's obviously good business sense to keep records of your paper contracts so that if you ever have a dispute over a contract you've got with somebody, you can show it in front of the court and say, here's what we agreed to, Your Honor. But you don't have to, and if you don't have a paper contract, it doesn't mean that it's going to be per se unenforceable contract. You can always bring in parole evidence as to what the terms were and things like that. But in the electronic world, if you don't do it, it's very likely that you're not going to be able to enforce your contract. So there are some things you have to jump through with respect to the electronic world that you don't have to jump through in the paper world. There are also particular provisions that pertain to consumer transactions in the electronic world. And eSign and UEDA both define consumers as people that are using a good or service for your home, family, household use. So, you know, downloading a product from the internet to your home computer, you're going to be a consumer in that instance. If you're downloading it at your work and you're using it for work purposes, you're in the commercial setting and you're not in the consumer setting. And this is an important distinction because for consumers, you have additional requirements you have to fulfill when you actually want to do your transaction. And there are about probably eight to ten requirements. And a lot of these actually depend upon the type of transaction you're doing, because, because UEDA and eSign are not only provisions that deal with contracts, because they deal with other kinds of things you may be doing with a consumer, a lot of these really aren't as applicable to contracts as they are to other things, but you still have to make sure you take care of them. The first one is that you've got to get the affirmative consent of the actual consumer to do business electronically. You have to allow them that option. You have to give them the ability to do business on paper if they don't want to do business electronically on the contract. So in other words, you have to let them do business on paper. Now, this is, of course, this is one of those places that we talked about, that I just talked about, that is probably not as applicable to contracts as it is to other types of things. I mean, if you're in the financial industry, for example, and you're wanting to provide all your notices electronically, this is more important because you've got an ongoing relationship. Where if you're doing a one-time software license download and they don't want to do business with you on paper, you don't have to do business with them. You just have to provide them that option if you're going to be going forward. So there's that requirement. In addition to that, you've got to allow them the ability to withdraw their consent, and you've got to describe the scope of consent in a clear and conspicuous manner. So you've got to let them know exactly what they're consenting to. Are they consenting to a one-time electronic transaction? Are they consenting to doing business with you over a period of time electronically, where you'll be providing them electronic information periodically? Those type of things. In addition to that, you've got to describe how they can withdraw their consent, how they can update their information to you so that they can actually send you information, or you can send them information so they can withdraw their consent. You have to tell them how they can get a paper record of the contract. So, you have to tell them how they can get a paper record of the contract, and you have to tell them what you're going to charge for it, too. So you've got to let them know that information, and you've got to tell them the hardware and software requirements for storing and retrieving the document, and notify them of any changes to the hardware and software necessary to actually store and retrieve the document. Now, this probably isn't a huge, again, these two requirements are not a big deal when you're dealing with contracts, because you can always just send the person a .txt file or even a PDF file in most cases, because almost everybody these days has the ability to open up a PDF file, at least some of the earlier versions, and a .txt file anybody can open. So in general, you can satisfy this with very little hassle on the part of the actual contracting parties. And then finally, you've got to obtain the consent in a way that shows that it works. This means that you've got to have them click through something or have them show you that the way that they consent to you is a way that then they can actually get the document. So online, for example, if you have someone click through a document online, clearly that shows that they have the web browser and everything to be able to view the electronic document. Pretty basic stuff, but you can definitely trip up if you don't satisfy those things, and then you've got a possible unenforceable contract. So what are some other issues that it bears thinking about when you're thinking about an electronic contract and some of the issues as to how an electronic contract differs from a paper contract? Well, there's basically sort of three other things other than the consumer issues we've talked about and the storage and retrieval issues we've talked about. And the first is something dealing with agency and authority. And this is one of those issues that may be a practical problem, and it may not be a practical problem. And in the paper world, obviously, most times when you do business with someone, you have them sign on the dotted line. They sign their name, a signature, which can obviously be verified. You have them put their title, and you have them put the name of their company or their address if they're an individual, or the Social Security number, perhaps, or things like that. So you have a way to then go back and verify, yeah, this is John Smith, and he entered into this contract. When you're dealing with people in an electronic world, a lot of times the contracts simply have, you know, an I agree button at the bottom of the page or something like that. And you don't know who the person is on the other side of that contract. And it could be that you're dealing with the CFO of a company who's buying your software, and they're entering into the license agreement, and they click through the agreement and you're fine, because generally they have the authority to bind that company to the contract, and you can rely on that. But alternatively, you could just have a clerk or a janitor on the other side of the contract, and they're entering into the contract, or you could have an installer or somebody who actually isn't able to represent that company who's entering into the contract. And in that case, you may have a situation where there actually hasn't been a manifestation of mutual assent by the other party, because you've got somebody who doesn't have authority to bind that other party entering into the contract for you. This is an issue that people don't all often think about. It's really easy to correct, and a lot of people correct it by simply having a registration page before you get to the contract or something, where you actually put your name in and put your address in and your other information in, that then is kept along with the record of the actual terms and conditions so that they can verify that. Or, for example, rather than just having a simple click at the bottom of the document, you have the person fill in their name and other pertinent information, and then they click through, and then that way you've got a way to actually know who you're dealing with. if you're doing business with the state and federal government, there are a whole host of rules that may actually apply that you've got to worry about. And most of those are process-oriented and things like that. There may be some substantive rules as well, especially if you're selling to the Department of Defense or something along those lines. So you still got to worry about those issues, and you've got to follow their particular guidelines in terms of contracting with the government. There are also some international issues that you may need to pay attention to. Now, generally, this is not terribly important, because the fact is that the international community, or at least most countries that you're likely to do business with, Western Europe, Asia, things like that, they're not going to have a statute of frauds or really have the same, put it like this, they never had the same level of paranoia about were electronic contracts real contracts, were they real writings and things like that. So you generally don't have the procedural issues that you have in the United States. There are some, but there are a whole host of issues that whenever you do business with somebody in a foreign country, whole new set of laws you have to deal with and things like that. So you've always got to pay attention to those issues, whether you're doing business paper, oral, what have you. But in the electronic world, there may be a couple snags in there as well to pay attention to. And then don't be sure that, don't forget other legal requirements. Just because, again, eSign and UEDA have been passed and allow you to actually have an electronic contract rather than a paper contract, doesn't mean you can ignore other laws that may apply in this instance. And there's specific language in both the acts that says that there may be other consequences that affect whether or not the electronic contract is enforceable. So it still makes sense to pay attention to the standard legal requirements. I'm going to switch gears for a second here. We're going to talk about the enforcement problems that you may encounter when you're dealing in the electronic world. And we're going to cover three basic ideas, and then we're going to talk about a couple of sample cases that have come out since 2002 that are things to just sort of pay attention to, and they'll help us kind of walk through some of the issues. Most of the issues that have come up with electronic contracts deal with issues about, have the parties actually intended to enter into a contract? And for the most part, these issues have come up in the context of the type of agreement that people are actually entering into. And generally, there have been really different outcomes depending upon whether or not you're dealing with a click wrap agreement or a browse wrap agreement. And I don't know who knows. These are generally pretty common terms these days, but a click wrap agreement is an agreement where you actually click on something and you actually accept the terms. And a browse wrap is an agreement where you've got a hyperlink on the page, for example, or you've got a document that just simply says, by using this software or by using this service, you agree to be bound by the terms set forth below. In other words, it's more of a passive acceptance of the contract than a click-through, which is more of an active, actually sort of almost signing the document by clicking through the I agree. And, generally, the legal landscape out there right now is that both of these documents both of these types of electronic contracts are generally enforceable. And the weight of authority right now is that these documents are as good as a paper document. You don't have to worry, assuming that you've satisfied, of course, the requirements that we've been talking about. But there's generally not a problem with either one of these documents. But there has been a greater reluctance by courts to allow all kinds of browse wrap agreements to be enforceable. They've taken a closer scrutiny with the browse wraps because it's more difficult to determine whether or not the parties have actually manifested an intent to be bound. So we'll look at a couple cases of that a little later. There are also other outcome influencing variables that have generally guided sort of the way the law has come out in this area. And I'm talking about things like, who's wearing the white hat in the particular case that you're talking about. Are you dealing with business to business, where you're generally presumed to be dealing with two sophisticated parties? Are you dealing with consumers, where you have to, courts will be more likely to look and make sure that there was a real process that the consumer went through and did actually manifest their intent to be bound, because they're sensitive that this can be abused. And let's face it, I mean, we've all clicked through documents that we haven't read that generally probably have you sign away your life. I mean, there are Microsoft documents that you click through that for XP, that have you agree that they can download information from your machine and things like that. So there's a whole host of things that are in these documents that courts are trying to think about when they're thinking about who's wearing the white hat and should we really enforce this from an equitable standpoint and things like that. But generally, they've taken the view that if you enter into the document, whether it's browse wrap or click wrap, we're going to go ahead and enforce it like a contract. So let's talk about some sample cases. The first three we're going to talk about really revolve around sort of the browse wrap issues and how courts have treated browse wraps. And then the second two really are sort of slightly different issues, but I think they're going to illustrate some points to think about when you're dealing with electronic contracts, when you're trying to write your electronic contract or what have you. The spec case was an interesting case, and it was a case where a guy named Christopher Specht, I think was his name, downloaded a Netscape module, and it ended up that module was flawed, and ended up sending his information or disclosing his personal information out on the internet, basically. And he wasn't the only person to have this problem. A lot of people had this problem, apparently. Well, I guess I should say allegedly disclosed his information, but essentially, he and a bunch of other people sued Netscape in a class action lawsuit, and they said, you know, we're suing you for violations of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and yada, 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 filled in a whole host of things. And Netscape came back saying, well, we're going to arbitrate this thing because we have this arbitration clause in the browse wrap agreement that you entered into when you downloaded this module. And the thing is that by having an arbitration clause in there, it essentially would blow the class action out. So it essentially would squash the claim. And the Second Circuit took a look at the contract, and they said, we're not going to enforce that. And the reason why they didn't enforce it was because they didn't think that it was a reasonable person would have determined that they were entering into these terms. In other words, there was no manifestation of assent on the part of Specht and the other people who had downloaded this particular agreement, or this particular software. And the details of the actual document were that it was a little tiny hyperlink at the bottom of the page, down below the fold of the screen. So you had to scroll down to get to it, and it had terms that were pretty onerous in it, and basically there was not enough notice there to allow someone to really know that these terms went with this particular piece of software that you were downloading. Now the interesting thing is that this type of analysis is probably more focused because of the fact that we're dealing with an electronic environment. Because if you think about all the contracts you enter into every day, you think about when you enter a parking garage and you pull a ticket, and there's terms on the back of the ticket that talk about the parking garage's liability and things like that. And you know, chances are a court's not going to strike the terms on the back of that parking ticket because they're going to assume that your average Joe knows that when they enter the parking garage and their car gets stolen, that you know it wasn't the parking garage's fault, and that there were probably terms on the back of the ticket and things like that. So you know, part of this may be due to the fact that it's a new medium and the court's viewing it as, you know, this is a new medium. People don't necessarily know how to behave online and things like that. But nevertheless, this case made a lot of people nervous because then they were thinking to themselves, you know, what do I have to do to make my document enforceable? You know, God, am I going to end up like Netscape? The bottom line is that it probably hasn't had the impact people thought it would, which is good. In other words, it really hasn't been followed by many other courts, and it's been very, very, very limited, very narrowly to its facts. But there have been other cases that have talked about browse wraps as well, and the second one here, which is DeFontes versus Dell Computers, was a similar situation. It was a situation where DeFontes and others were suing Dell on a class action basis because they claimed Dell overcharged them on their service charges and things like that. Dell said, no, you guys entered into this browse wrap we had, and the browse wrap has an arbitration clause, and et cetera. This was actually in Texas, and the court here said, we're not going to enforce this again because we don't think that there was really a real manifestation of a mutual assent. And in this situation, it was actually slightly different than the Speck case, in that there were actually three documents, and all three documents were the same document, the same browse wrap, the same form of the browse wrap agreement. There was one browse wrap which was on Dell's site, on their website. There was a document that came with the computer itself, a hard copy paper document. And then there was a paper copy of the same license terms in the actual purchase order itself. So there were three copies of this thing. But the interesting thing is none of them actually said, if you don't agree to these terms, you can return the computer and we'll give you your money back. They did say that there's a satisfaction, full satisfaction guarantee, warranty, and things like that, but they didn't say, return the computer, we'll give you your money back. And that was sort of the crucial element here, because generally, for a shrink wrap document, I don't know if you know what a shrink wrap document is, but it's basically the pieces of paper that come with your computer with the manuals and things like that that say, by using this computer, you agree to these terms. It's the same thing as a browse wrap, only it's in hard copy paper form. Well, shrink wraps have been around, obviously, for longer, and courts have upheld shrink wraps for a long time. But in this case, but again, they've been upheld basically on the basis of if you return the computer, we'll give you your money back. In other words, there's this idea that you're affirmatively agreeing to be bound, and if you don't want to be bound, we don't have to worry about having a contract, as opposed to a situation where the court said, in this situation, I'm not really sure that this guy really had any recourse to actually return the computer and get his money back if he didn't like the actual terms of the document. So this case is one that didn't really make people terribly nervous because they figured, this really is pretty much in line with the old shrink wrap cases, because it says that as long as you make it so that we can return the stuff and get our money back if we don't like the terms, we're okay. And so if you notice, most times when you see a shrink wrap and a click wrap, you'll actually see that language. If you don't click I accept, it'll say, please either don't proceed any further with registration or return the software for a refund or something along those lines. So you're making it clear that, you're making it clear when the people actually enter into a contract, and that if they do so freely, and that they're actually assenting, and that we've got a real exchange of promises there. The register.com versus Vario case sort of illustrates the fact, it's a good illustration of the fact that courts have realized that browser apps need to be enforceable. The register.com versus Vario case is a case where Vario, which is a company, was poaching information off the register.com site. And they were poaching the Whois information so they could market to the people. And each time that you pull information from the register.com site, it's accompanied by terms and conditions that say how you can use the information and things like that. So register.com sued Vario for breaching its license terms and won. And this was the case even though Vario didn't have to click through anything, and you didn't actually have to see the terms prior to pulling the information out or anything like that. But the court said two things. It said, first of all, you may not have known it the first time, and it's arguable whether that was enforceable because the terms weren't in front of you prior to entering into the transaction, but you definitely knew it second, third, and fourth time that you pulled the information out. And also, you pretty much admitted that you knew there was an agreement there. The fact that you didn't read it isn't a big deal because you knew it was there, you should have read it, so we're going to go ahead and enforce it. So the bottom line is that courts are willing to enforce browser app agreements unless there is a reason why they can see that it's not reasonable to enforce it, either because there wasn't a manifestation of mutual assent, because the reasonable person wouldn't know there were actually terms that go with this, or the assent was essentially illusory because there was no recourse, you couldn't actually return the stuff and get your money back. So those are really the only, those three cases are really the three big cases with respect to browse wraps, and those are the two cases at the top are really the only two glitches. Click wrap agreements have been mostly fine. In other words, if you do a click wrap agreement, courts are going to be quick to say, look, you clicked through, I don't care that you didn't actually read the terms, because no one really does, but you clicked through, you had the opportunity to read it, and you agreed to accept it. The Cohn versus PayPal case, though, is a good case for illustrating the point that even if you follow the procedural points that are required to enter into a valid electronic contract, you've got to pay attention to the other law that's out there. Because the Cohn case was a case where Cohn was using PayPal, ended up bringing a class action suit against PayPal because PayPal was basically debiting his account without his knowing it, allegedly, right? Yeah, but so anyway, brought it to PayPal. PayPal said we're gonna arbitrate this thing like Dell and Netscape, and this was in California. The California court said, no, we're not going to enforce that arbitration clause. But they didn't invalidate the electronic contract. They just said the arbitration clause is unconscionable under standard contract law. We're not going to allow that to stand, and we're not going to enforce it. So the bottom line is, even if you've got a valid electronic contract, you've still got to worry about all the other legal requirements that a paper person would have to worry about, or an oral contract. You have to worry about an oral contract as well. And then the final case here I want to talk about is ILAN Systems versus NetScout. And the reason why I want to talk about this case is because it doesn't really deal... It was a case where a ClearCrap was actually found to be enforceable, but it sort of illustrates the sort of what I call the dark side of electronic contracting, which is that it's really sort of be careful what you wish for. Because in this case, you had two companies, ILAN Systems and NetScout, who had entered into a paper contract, a reseller agreement, where ILAN Systems was reselling NetScout stuff. And then subsequent to that, they entered into purchase orders dealing with purchasing the products. And then subsequent to that, ILAN Systems was clicking through a ClickRap agreement that came with NetScout software. And the reseller agreement was missing certain terms. It was missing things like limitations of liability and things like that that you normally see in a contract. And that, those were also missing in the purchase order as well. But they were in the ClickRap agreement. And so when they got into a dispute with each other, NetScout said, well, we're only going to pay you this much money because we're only obligated to under the terms of our limitations of liability in our ClickRap document. And ILAN said, well, no, you know, we didn't agree to that. That doesn't apply. The paper documents apply. The electronic terms don't apply. Those are impermissible amendments to the document. And the court said, no, they're not. I mean, we're going to enforce those things as a real contract. And they fill in terms that weren't present before. And there are valid ways to amend the contract. There was consideration. There was offer and acceptance for that software. We're going to go ahead and allow the parties to basically sue under the contract, but we're going to apply those terms to it. And so what this sort of shows is that there are definitely some dangers to the fact that electronic records are now able to form contracts, because you got an exchange of emails that go back and forth between two people, and one of them says, I'll mow your lawn for $5 next Saturday, and the other person says, yeah, and you do it by email, you've got yourself a contract. Even if you've got an underlying paper document, you subsequently agree in emails to do something a different way, you run the risk that you've actually amended that underlying document. So you've got... It makes it more difficult to actually police what your employees and things are doing. Now, there are ways people try to sort of solve this problem, and one of the ways is in the actual underlying document itself. They say, we're only going to be able to amend this thing by pen and ink, using paper, things like that. That may help. The other thing is, a lot of times you'll see emails come out from a company, and at the bottom of it, with their disclaimer of privilege and confidential and all that other kind of stuff, you'll see a note that says, this email cannot form a contract unless it says, you know, we're entering into a contract, or this is an electronic contract, or something along those lines. So they'll try to monitor directly the fact that employees will send out all these emails, and they don't want them to be binding the company for just any reason.
In that last case, does it matter who did the click through? If they were an agent of the company versus...
In this case, there was no agency question. But there could be that issue. I mean, if you've got you know, a real lower level employee that, for example, NetScout should know doesn't have the ability to bind ILAN, then in that case, a court would probably look at it and say, well, NetScout, you knew that these people were just, you know, the janitor for ILAN, and that they didn't have the ability really to bind ILAN. So you didn't reasonably rely on what was the apparent authority of that person to enter into the contract. They will look at that. In this case, it wasn't an issue because it was someone who was an officer or something along those lines, so it wasn't ever pled out that way. So now I want to just kind of go through some practical pointers in terms of putting together a good electronic document. The first thing is thinking about what you're trying to accomplish. Again, because UEDA and eSign govern all different types of things, whether it's notices, consents, etc., that's the first question you need to ask yourself. And, of course, in this case, we're really dealing... My talk has been mostly about electronic contracts. But there are a whole host of other things you can do with electronic documents. Second is thinking about what laws apply to these activities in terms of, are you dealing with... Are you a financial institution that's subject to Gramm-Leach-Bliley? Are you a healthcare organization subject to HIPAA? Things like that. Knowing the substantive law that applies may very well impact exactly what you need to do. And in connection with that, it's helpful to get subject matter expertise in terms of knowing, what do I have to do if I want to enter into an agreement and have someone purchase insurance from me? you're going to have certain things you're going to have to jump through, certain hoops you're going to have to jump through in order to do that. Finally, next, you need to examine the process that you're going to use for contracting. Are you going to use a browse wrap? Does it make sense to use a browse wrap based upon the type of transaction you're doing? If you're doing a transaction that's, you know, 5-6 figures, you may not want to rely on a browse wrap to do that. Are you going to use a click wrap? What kind of click wrap are you going to use? Do you care about the issue of agency or authority, that you want to have someone actually use a registration page or the like to deal with an issue? Or is it an issue where you really are not that concerned that someone's going to be entering into this agreement and then they're not going to be able to bind the person that they're entering into it on behalf of? So the process definitely matters in terms of the contract process itself. Finally, you definitely have to pay attention to who you think the people on the other side of the transaction are going to be. If you're dealing with consumers, we've already talked about there's a whole host of things you got to make sure happen in order to make that contract enforceable. And if you're dealing with government agencies and things like that, again, they're going to have their own particular terms and conditions and procedures that they're going to want you to go through in order to make the agreement work. Definitely pay attention to the geographic scope. If you were doing business with a European entity, you're going to have to worry about the European Data Directive. You're going to have to worry about things like that. If you're doing business in California, you're going to have to worry about California. So pay attention to that. Check for the specific exceptions that you've got under UEDA and eSign and the laws that apply there. Again, for most contract scenarios, you don't have those problems because you're dealing mostly with Articles 2 and 2A and general statutory contract law, which for the most part you're not going to have a problem with. But if you're dealing in certain areas, if you're dealing for example, if you're dealing with a consumer, if you're dealing with a consumer in the state of Maryland, for example, you have to worry about USITA and what USITA says in terms of how you need to handle things. So you have to pay attention to the exceptions. And that's basically it. What do we really talk about? Well, you know, generally, click wraps are enforceable, and there's the weight of authority is pretty huge in favor of that. Browse wraps are enforceable, but they are more dependent upon the facts and circumstances. If you're doing a browse wrap with a consumer and you put that arbitration clause in there, you may have a problem. You may want to go ahead and change that to a click wrap, because browse wraps are, even though they've been enforced, and for the most part they're going to be enforced, it's a little trickier of a proposition, so you're going to want to go ahead and do the click wrap process to assure yourself that you don't have that manifestation of mutual assent problem there. Offer acceptance, consideration, all the basic contracting stuff still matters. If your arbitration clause is unconscionable, the courts may still strike it, regardless of whether you're doing business on paper or whether you're doing business electronically. It's not going to matter. And then remember the how-to guide in terms of how to set up your particular document. You want to jump through all the steps. You want to make sure you're covering everything that you need to cover, and that your procedure works for your business, and that it also is going to make your contract something that isn't going to get thrown out in court. And finally, keep records. Again, the only real difference besides the consumer stuff with respect to electronic contracting is that you've got an affirmative obligation to keep records so that you can produce the record if there is ever a problem with the contract, and that you can make it accessible to the other party to the contract. That's an essential step. So you need to keep records of your transaction, whether it's recording what the document looked like on your website from January of 2004 to, you know, May of 2004, or something along those lines, keeping track of how you change your documents, keeping track if you're actually entering into click wraps, preserving a copy once it's clicked through. And there are a whole host of technical ways that you can actually do this, but it's very important to keep records. And that's it. Are there any questions? Or? Yeah?
You said that click wraps are pretty much universally enforced. How often have they been not enforced, either based on lack of mutual assent or unconscionability?
I haven't actually seen a case where a click wrap hasn't been enforced per se. In the only cases I've seen are ones that are similar to the case that we discussed, in which there was a provision that was found to be lacking other legal requirements in order to be enforceable. Yeah, unconscionability, that kind of stuff. generally, if you click through, especially in this day and age, I mean, if there was going to be a case where they would have found it unenforceable, it would have been probably a few years ago because, again, just by the show of hands in this room, you'll be hard-pressed to find anybody who hasn't clicked through a contract and doesn't know that when they're clicking through, they're basically signing that document by clicking the document. So,
even if they're not aware of the scope of the document. And even the document says, you know, in July you'll come out and be Bill Gates' towel boy.
Right. Well, right. And the thing is, you may be able to rely on unconscionability for certain things that are beyond the pale, but in general, courts are going to assume that you read what you sign.
What about when you're changing the terms of a previous agreement? I mean, that's the worst thing about Microsoft is that they keep changing the rules, and you don't have a whole lot of choice. If you need to download Batch, you have to agree to their terms.
Well, you know, we can get into a whole discussion about what's the worst thing about Microsoft, but that's one of the the problems that people who are drafting USITA were sort of caught up in. They were caught up in, you know, we want to make sure that consumers are getting a fair shake with respect to contracts, and so they tried to put in some consumer protections in USITA. Again, USITA was not very successful. It's only been passed by two states, and it's not going to go anywhere. I mean, it's just never going to go anywhere. The issue is that with respect to Microsoft and others that try to change their contracts in midstream, there are definitely ways that you need to go about dealing with amendments to contracts. You need to probably do some sort of opt-out if you're actually physically, if you entered into an agreement with a consumer, for example, and then you want to come back later and change the terms of how you're going to handle that consumer's data later on, you probably need to let them opt out from continuing to do business with you at that point, because if you don't, then you really don't have the offer and acceptance with respect to that new amendment that you're doing, and that amendment may not be valid. So each time you do an amendment, you still have to jump through the same process as when you do the original contract. But if you do that, if you say, we're going to give you this download, but you got to click through this agreement before you get the download, and you click through the agreement, the courts are going to apply the same analysis they apply. They're going to say, you chose to do it, you entered into this contract, you can always go and instead of using the Microsoft product, you can use the other product. You can use Linux, or you can use Mozilla's products or something like that. And so there's really no legal way that the courts are going to invalidate that. The only way that you can do it is sort of by your consumer choice, by trying to choose something under Microsoft. I'm sorry, I'll get you next. Go ahead. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Under the statute of frauds, aren't they permitted, if they're under 18, to void that contract if they change their mind later?
Yeah, it's not.
How do I protect myself with a contract that may or may not really exist if I'm
right.
in a household using it?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. It's actually not the statute of frauds, but there are. Oh. You're right. If you're a minor, if you're not of age, and in Georgia it's 18, and I think in a lot of states it is as well, you can actually repudiate the contract. And you're right, if you're selling products that you know are going to be going to people that aren't of age, then you probably need to have a registration process or something along those lines where you get some sort of ID that will allow you to verify that those people are 18. And you can get like a credit card number or something along those lines, and that's probably the only way to do it. So it goes back to the issue about, you know, knowing who you're dealing with. And it's harder to do electronically, obviously, because you're not face to face in a retail store selling stuff, but there are ways to do it, and that's the only thing I can tell you to do. There are a whole host of issues that that pertain to if for example you're offering this on a website, children products. You have to there's a whole host of laws that apply to children under the age of 13 and things like that you have to comply with. But that's not really contracting. That's in terms of you're trying to entice people that are under the age of 13 to your website. Children's Online Privacy Act. It's a whole other issue, but.
You see, what I'm thinking about is also educational software, gaming software, online utilities like a Google, that, you know, you don't want to exclude people under 18 just because you're afraid they'll repudiate the contract later, but on the other hand.
Well, it depends on what you're selling. I mean, if you're selling something for a relatively low dollar amount, and you're. and you know, you want to get the product out there, and you want it to be used a lot by people under the age of 18, you may not be having a, you may not have a huge risk there, because if they repudiate the contract, they have to, they can't use your software product anymore, for example. So the chances of them doing that are probably pretty low, unless, you know, unless you've done something wrong or something like that, in which case they'll repudiate it. Again, they don't have to use the software anymore, and maybe you lost that on some licensing fees if you're on a subscription basis, something like that. But on the whole, there's probably not a lot of risk depending upon your business model. Because if you're selling a, you know, operating system or something like that, you're probably not selling to minors. If you're selling, you know, gaming software like you're talking about, you know, maybe you are, but maybe you'll take that risk. So, sorry, go ahead.
Back to amending contracts, mm-hmm. and getting consent. Mm-hmm. Some contracts I've seen, they write in the first contract, says if we change the terms of this contract, you automatically agree to it. What's the
those are questionable, right? Because how does that really work? I mean, if the parties don't agree subsequently to amend the contract, then you really have this problem of there hasn't been consideration for this future change. There hasn't been a manifestation of mutual assent. The same rules that apply to the initial contract apply to each time you amend it, because that's basically a new contract each time. That's the way to think about it. So that it probably is not going to work if you challenge it. Again, if you can opt out or something like that, then you may be able to say, well, they had the ability to opt out once we told them that we're changing the contract, and they went ahead and stayed with our terms and conditions. Under that circumstance, a court may say, well, that's fine. They had the ability to say no, and they didn't. They kept on with it. We're going to go ahead and enforce that. But it's tricky, and one of the things is that obviously the best case scenario with the least amount of risk is you have them click through, I agree to these new terms for the next 12 months or whatever it is, or until next time we change the contract. But a lot of people don't want to do that because it's cumbersome and they don't want to alert people that they're actually changing the terms. So they'll just say, you know, we've modified our terms of our website. If you don't like it, we can stop doing business together. But if you do, you know, you agree to keep doing business with us like that. And that probably will be upheld because there's a new contract and you've actually had the ability to say, I don't want to do it anymore, or I want to keep going.
It's like credit card companies.
Yeah.
Pretty much. They send you new terms whenever
they do. Right. And if you want to cancel your credit card, you can't see a credit card. Same kind of thing. Is it necessarily fun? No, but I mean, for the consumer, it's not necessarily fun. But at the same time, you know, people are going to presume that you read the terms in front of you. I never read the terms of my credit card terms. I don't read the huge Gramm-Leach Bliley disclosures that come out from my bank. But you know, they're there for me if I want to read them. If I don't, I don't have to. And this is sort of the same thing with a click wrap. If you want to read it, you can certainly read it. If you want to try to send it back with some changes, you can do that too. You're not going to get very far, but you can always try. But you know, and that's one of the things that I think that people were worried about was, you know, in the electronic world, isn't going to be easier for people to cram documents down people's throats? And it probably is. I mean, I can tell you that when I represent my clients and they're asking me how they want to put together a contract, you know, I tell them, you know, the best thing to do if you want to make sure that you probably get the fewest changes coming back is psychologically, you want to impose terms that look like they're a form document, and you want to make it look like we never change it for anybody. And one way to do that is to just put them in electronic form, because most people assume that, well, these are online terms, I can't change them, and that's a good way to do it. And it works in the business context, it works in the consumer context. Now, it doesn't always work, because I'll see people try to give me electronic terms, and I'll say, well, no, we're not going to agree to that. We're going to go ahead and put this on paper, and we're going to negotiate some stuff. But obviously, in the consumer context, you don't have the same leverage as you do in the business context. But yeah, I mean, that's a valid concern, definitely. I see another hand over here somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, just to bring me up to speed on this, what you're saying is that contractual law, of course, remains the same, but because of the new age we now live in, that primarily how you would agree to a contract, the contract is formed in the way it's always been formed all the time. It's just that when we agree, the methodology for agreement has changed.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, or it's changed in the way that there's a new medium that you can actually offer and accept that there wasn't really before,
okay,
right?
Acceptance.
Yeah. So I mean, for example, I mean, contracts have been around before there was writing. I mean, you know, people have been agreeing to things before there was writing, and this really doesn't change the fundamental premises of how you need to go about contracting. Other than that, if you want to do it electronically in the United States, you got to fulfill these requirements if you want to guarantee, if you want to make sure that it has a chance of being enforced. So yeah, basically you're right. I mean, it doesn't really change much, but it makes sense to pay attention to these things. And it does mean that when you write an electronic contract, you're going to write it differently than you write a paper contract, because you're going to say, by agreeing below, I'm certifying that I'm 18 years of age, that I can bind whoever the company is that I'm binding, that that I agree to do business electronically, I affirmatively consent to do business electronically, all those kind of things. You need to build those into your documents, which you don't have to do in a paper environment. But at the same point in time, the analysis that's used when looking at whether or not they're enforceable is going to be the same that you look at when you're doing a paper document for the most part. Yeah?
What kind of things do courts find onerous in arbitration agreements and would throw them out?
Well, the issues in all these cases had to do with the fact that these cases all involve class actions, which are where a bunch of people get together and they sue somebody over an issue that they basically have the same grievance for. And the issue with arbitration clauses is that when you have an arbitration clause, it prevents you from having a class action, because then you have to arbitrate individually with the company rather than as a class. And effectively, that's going to stop the lawsuit for the most part, because most of the times we're talking about, dollars and cents that actually people lost, but when you mass it together, you're talking about a $30 million claim, and then lawyers will take that claim and litigate it for you, whereas they're not going to litigate your $1.95 claim for you. And so that's really the crux of why those clauses are looked at, because they tend to give, or the courts will say they tend to give a company an unfair advantage, because they'll essentially throw out the ability for people to get recourse with respect to a particular cause of action. So That's really why arbitration. But the other things that are looked at other than arbitration clauses are things like limitations of liability. If you're limiting your liability down impermissibly in a way, a court may say that's not conscionable. Probably less likely to worry about something like that. Warranties and things like that. There may be some actual warranties you have to give under law, under the Magnuson-Moss Act and things like that. And so courts may throw some things out, but generally it's going to be issues that are really bad, and it's going to be things where the court feels like you're basically taking away the right to effectively sue under the contract, so there really isn't a mutual promise, because we're basically imposing these terms on you. You got to take them, and if we do anything wrong, you guys can't even do anything about it. And so that's essentially what they're looking for, is it's so bad that it makes it almost meaningless that the consumer actually has a contract with you. It's a real fuzzy analysis they do, and to be honest with you, the case, the Cone versus PayPal case, was a California case. So California is sort of in this circuit called the Ninth Circuit, way out on the West Coast, and they have their own way of thinking about things. But they're a lot less predictable. So I mean, the Ninth Circuit, yeah. So the thing is that a lot of this is dependent upon the judge you get in front of and how sympathetic they are to consumers and things like that in terms of what they're going to find unconscionable. Having read the case, it's not real clear. I mean, the arbitration clause wasn't special in any way. It wasn't written really, really badly or onerously or anything like that. The judge just basically looked at it and said, I'm pretty sure PayPal did these horrible things. I mean, they pretty much overcharged this guy's account. If this guy doesn't have the ability to sue in a class action, he's probably not going to get his money back, and PayPal's going to go pretty much without having to pay anything and without any kind of penalty. I'm going to go ahead and throw this out. So a lot of times it really depends on who's wearing the white hat, who looks good, what's actually happened. I mean, the Vario case, the Register Vario case, the terms there weren't in front of anybody, and so you had the same browser app situation, but in that situation, Vario was the one who was actually doing something wrong, and so the court enforced the terms back on Vario. So a lot of times it does matter, who you are in terms of how the outcome is going to be in the litigation. It's kind of a long answer to your question, but, anyway.
Are there any
Oh, that's right. If you think of it,
there's a lot of law in arbitration agreements too, which is a whole separate deal.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've noticed occasionally when you install a program and you pop up that click-through agreement, mm-hmm. they'll leave the text field writable.
Mm-hmm.
I just delete all the text and I agree to nothing.
You're good.
What actually would happen if you came to court in a dispute on it? Like,
well,
what's the deal?
Depending upon what you actually did. It may be that if you send it back and they preserved a record of it, and basically they followed their procedures and you did that, it may be that the terms you've inserted may be the terms that you can say that they agreed to. Okay,
but
it right, it, or it may be that they say, well, what we've got here is we don't really have a meeting of the minds, we don't really have a contract at all. Or they could say, we don't know what the contract is, so we're going to let the parties kind of tell us what they thought they meant when one party sent out one set of terms and the other party came back with nothing. I agree to nothing, which would be an interesting case. And if you actually litigate one of those, let me know, because I'd be interested to hear what happens. Well,
I'm a computer programmer by trade, not a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, it really comes down to leverage. I mean, if you've got enough leverage, you can negotiate any kind of document at all. If you're a consumer and you're negotiating with Microsoft, they're probably not going to have the time of day to talk to you about your concerns about their contract. You know, they're not going to bother. So it really depends on what you're talking about. I mean, if you're a programmer and you're dealing with, you want to install a product for your business, for example, and you're dealing with another startup, chances are you can probably negotiate the terms with them. It really depends. Now, it makes it, again, the form you put your document in, if you put it on a click wrap, it psychologically, people tend to think, I can't negotiate these terms or something like that. Now, you obviously don't have that problem, which is a good thing. But some people do. And that's why people will put terms on their website rather than putting them in a piece of paper, because they think it's more. You know, this is something that actually kind of goes back to pre-personal computer and things like that. When people wanted to put together a document they didn't want to make negotiable, they would put it in as a form document rather than writing it in, like, you know, Times New Roman 12 point. You put it in a form, put a line down the middle, dual column, Arial 8 point, you know, margins real slim. It makes it look like this is, it's all boilerplate. I can't do anything about it. I'm just going to sign it. And so there are psychological ways people try to get you to sign their agreements as is, and this is just a new way people try to do that, is by putting things on an electronic form rather than on paper. So, somebody else had a question, or would I imagine things? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, to your point, though, people may not care in terms of vis-a-vis the contract, but if you're dealing with a software that may be risky, that has certain elements to it, if you license that to enough people, then you may have the PayPal case. You may have a class action brought against you, and in that case, the ClickWrap may actually help you out.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And it would not be enforceable.
Huh.
They laughed at me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't. So you were actually one of the plaintiffs in the
yeah.
case? Interesting.
They're going to give me about $800, but I'd like to get more, but that's legitimately my damage.
Wow, interesting.
So they said that they weren't subject to uniform commercial code, which I thought was ridiculous. Did they just not have a good lawyer?
Well, you know, the interesting thing. That's an interesting question. I'll get your first question first, and that is, I'm not sure that they were actually subject to the Uniform Commercial Code, and that's because technically Article 2 pertains to sales of goods and doesn't necessarily pertain to licenses or services. Article 2A pertains to leases, and actually one of the things that we sort of talked about was USITA, and USITA came out of old Article 2B discussions, where at the late 90s, people, law professors and whatnot, got together and they said, you know, Article 2 doesn't really cover software transactions. We got to have something in the Uniform Commercial Code that covers software transactions. So they started writing Article 2B, which was supposed to cover software transactions. That morphed into USITA, which then got torn up by various infighting and things like that, and then ended up pretty much dead in the water. So probably they're not technically bound. It's until UCC. Okay. Right.
In fact, it was the clause about the liberty of the mails was the liberty of the agent.
Okay.
And they said in fact, the person I talked to hadn't even heard of it.
Well, that's not good.
That
I mean, the thing is that.
So, you know, when I said that I knew that they were doing something that wouldn't be opposable when people sued them. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm worried that I won't get my money, because I knew that they were doing something I agreed with anyway.
Well, I wouldn't worry about that because the fact is that even if you thought that they were doing something bad,
you
put them on notice. And the UCC Article 2, there's an issue as to whether or not it applies to software. A lot of people say it's not a sale of goods. Technically, it's really not a sale of goods, but people generally apply those concepts when they're dealing with software licensing because a sale of goods is very analogous to a license of software, at least in terms of an actual commercial, from a commercial standpoint. Now, from an intellectual property standpoint, they're very different transactions. But that's really interesting. So PayPal ended up paying in that case. It sounded like pretty good. Excellent. Well, I think that again, it's a good point that even though you're contracting electronically, it's not going to mean that you can get out of the other common contract type doctrine that's going to apply. Whether you had entered that document on paper or what have you, you still would have been able to bring the same type of claims. The fact they're doing electronically shouldn't make a difference. Yeah. Well, you don't have the duty to inform them, but I think it's definitely good to let them know that. And it probably was actually maybe helpful even in the case when someone deposed the people from PayPal and said, did you ever know that these things would be unconscionable? And they would have to say either no, which would be a lie, or they would say, well, somebody did say that they thought this thing wasn't really fair, and then it makes them look bad. So it definitely doesn't hurt to form your objections. Now, again, most cases you're going to come up with the same situation. People are just going to tell you to go pound sand because they're not going to want to hear what you have to say. But that's again, it's a question of leverage. I mean, you're dealing with big companies and you're just a person. You're not going to have much in the way of recourse actually when you're entering into business with them. Now on the back end, you can get them sometimes if they do something wrong. So, yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Is much of the software that I click through or that I install has a clause saying that where there's a dispute, it'll be decided using the laws of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that all that software is going under USITA?
Yeah.
Okay. So even though it's only in a very limited geographic area, that it's going to apply over a lot more of the market.
Yeah, it applies to transactions that are governed by Maryland law. So, for example, in your case, if the contract expressly chooses the law of Maryland to govern the contract, then you're governed by USITA.
Okay.
And if it was to choose Georgia law, and you've got people that, for example, are in California and Iowa, USITA's probably not going to apply unless there's some. The California consumers. I shouldn't have chosen California. I should stay out of California. Let's say Florida and Iowa, then you're not going to have USITA apply there. You'll actually see some contracts that'll say, we're expressly disclaiming USITA, and whether or not that actually is going to work is a different story, because if you're subject to Maryland law and you're telling a judge you can apply Maryland law but you're not going to apply the following statutes, the judge may just tell you, you're not going to tell me what to do. I'm going to apply whatever law under this Maryland law I'm going to apply. So people will try that, and how effective that is, I don't know, because luckily I don't draft contracts that use Maryland law much, if at all. So I try to stay away from USITA because it's complicated in terms of I don't fully understand how USITA will work with UEDA and eSign in terms of how it's going to apply and things like that. I stay away from USITA.
It seems like a lot of the commercial software, the consumer software I'm using, is starting to connect that to, connected into Maryland.
Hmm.
Maryland
really?
Maryland in particular, I didn't realize Virginia was.
Really? That's interesting. Virginia obviously has a lot of tech activity in Virginia. But I guess most of the stuff I click through, I see a lot of Washington, and I see a lot of California, and I see a lot of New York, things like that. But I haven't really seen a whole lot of Maryland. That's interesting. I mean, USITA isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just something that you got to pay attention to when you're doing it because it's different.
It struck me because the moment you said Maryland, it clicked. Mm-hmm. I wondered why they were including that.
Yeah, I mean, so that's interesting. I've never seen people intentionally select Maryland for that reason, but. Anyway, you learn something every day, I guess. So, anything else? Anybody else have a question or anything? No? Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys. And if you have any questions, my email address is not there anymore, but feel free to give me a call. You can reach me probably through Scott and Dragon Con if you need to. So, thanks a lot.